Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. Two episodes in fairly close succession. There's only been, 12 hours or so since the last one. That's because I want them to all line up nicely so it finishes at the end of the year. We started the podcast a few days late. We started on January 3rd, I think. So it's not going to quite line up. So yeah, I'm doing a couple of extras, and that way there'll be a podcast for every day. It'll all align properly. This is Epilogue to Chapter 4. Having abandoned the conception of the ancients as to the divine subjection of the will of a nation to some chosen man and the subjection of that man's will to the deity, history cannot without contradictions take a single step till it has chosen one of two things: either a return to the former belief in the direct intervention of the deity in human affairs, or a definite explanation of the meaning of the force producing historical events and termed power. A return to the first is impossible. The belief has been destroyed, and so it is essential to explain what is meant by power. Napoleon ordered an army to be raised and go to war. We are so accustomed to that idea, and have become so used to it, that the question why 600,000 men went to fight when Napoleon uttered certain words seems to us senseless. He had the power, and so what he ordered was done. This reply is quite satisfactory if we believe that the power was given him by God, but as soon as we do not admit that, it becomes essential to determine what is the power one man had over others. It cannot be the direct physical power of a strong man over a weak one, a domination based on the application of threat of physical force like the power of Hercules, nor can it be based on the effect of moral forces, as in their simplicity some historians think, who say that the leading figures in history are heroes, that is, men gifted with a special strength of soul and mind called genius. This power cannot be based on the predominance of moral strength, for not to mention heroes such as Napoleon, about whose moral qualities opinions differ widely. History shows us that neither a Louis VI nor a Metternich, who ruled over millions of people, had any particular moral qualities, but on the contrary were generally morally weaker than any of the millions they ruled over. If the source of power lies neither in the physical nor the moral qualities of him who possesses it, it must evidently be looked for elsewhere, in the relations of the man who wields the power to the people. And that is how power is understood by the science of jurisprudence, that exchange bank of history which offers to exchange history's understanding of power for true gold. Power is the collective will of the people transferred by expression or tacit consent to their chosen rulers. In the domain of jurisprudence, which consists of discussions of how a state and power might be arranged were it possible for all that to be arranged, it is all very clear, but when applied to history, that definition of power needs explanation. The science of jurisprudence regards the state and power as the ancients regarded fire, namely as something existing absolutely. But for history, the state and power are merely phenomena, just as for modern physics, fire is not an element, but a phenomenon. From this fundamental difference between the view held by history and that held by jurisprudence, it follows that jurisprudence can tell minutely how, in its opinion, power should be constituted, and what power existing immutably outside time is but to history's questions about the meaning of the mutations of power in time it can answer nothing. If power be the collective will of the people transferred to their ruler, was Pugachev a representative of the will of the people? If not, then why was Napoleon one? Why was Napoleon III a criminal when he was taken prisoner at Boulogne? And why later on were those criminals whom he arrested? Do palace revolutions, in which sometimes only two or three people take part, transfer the will of the people to a new ruler? In international relations, is the will of the people also transferred to the conqueror? Was the will of the Confederation of the Rhine transferred to Napoleon in 1808? Was the will of the Russian people transferred to Napoleon in 1809, when our army, in alliance with the French, went to fight the Austrians? To these questions, three answers are possible. Either to assume, one, that the will of the people is always unconditionally transferred to the ruler or rulers they have chosen, and that therefore every emergence of a new power, every struggle against the power once appointed, should be absolutely regarded as an infringement of the real power, or two, that the will of the people is transferred to the rulers conditionally under definite and known conditions, and to show that all limitations, conflicts, and even destructions of power result from a non-observance by the rulers of the conditions under which their power was entrusted to them. 3. That the will of the people is delegated to the rulers conditionally, but that the conditions are unknown and indefinite, and that the appearance of several authorities, their struggles and their falls, results solely from the greater or lesser fulfillment by the rulers of these unknown conditions on which the will of the people is transferred from some people to others. And these are the three ways in which the historians do explain the relation of the people to their rulers. Some historians, failing in their simplicity to understand the question of the meaning of power, those biographical and special historians already referred to, seem to consider that the collective will of the people is unconditionally transferred to historical persons, and therefore when describing some single state, they assume that particular power to be the one absolute and real power, and that any force opposing this is not a power but a violation of power, mere violence. Their theory, suitable for primitive and peaceful periods of history, has the inconvenience in application to complex and stormy periods in the life of nations, during which various powers arise simultaneously and struggle with one another. That a legitimist historian will prove that the National Convention, the Directory, and the Bonaparte were mere infringers of the true power, while a Republican and a Bonapartist will prove the one that the Convention and the other that the Empire was the real power, and that all the others were violations of power. Evidently, the explanations furnished by these historians, being mutually contradictory, can only satisfy young children. Recognizing the falsity of this view of history, another set of historians say that power rests on a conditional delegation of the will of the people to their rulers, and that historical leaders have power only conditionally on carrying out the program the will of the people has by tacit agreement prescribed to them. But what this program consists in, these historians do not say, or if they do, they continually contradict one another. Each historian, according to his view of what constitutes a nation's progress, looks for these conditions in the greatness, wealth, freedom, or enlightenment of the citizens of France or some other country. But, not to mention the historian's contradictions as to the nature of this program, or even admitting that some one general program of these conditions exists, the facts of history almost always contradict the theory. If the conditions under which power is entrusted consist in the wealth, freedom, and enlightenment of the people, how is it that Louis XIV and John the Terrible end their reigns tranquilly, while Louis XVI and Charles I are executed by their people? To this question, the historians reply that Louis XIV's activity, contrary to the program, reacted on Louis XVI. But why did it not react on Louis XVI or on Louis XV? 14 and 15. Why should it just react on Louis XVI? And what is the term for such reactions? To these questions, there are and can be no answers. Equally little does this view explain why, for several centuries, the collective will is not withdrawn from certain rulers and their heirs, and then suddenly during a period of 50 years is transferred to the convention, to the directory, to Napoleon, to Alexander, to Louis the 18th, to Napoleon again, to Charles the 10th, to Louis Philippe, and to a republican government, and to Napoleon the 3rd. When explaining these rapid transfers of the people's will from one individual to another, especially in view of international relations, conquest, and alliances, the historians are obliged to admit that some of these transfers are not normal delegations of the people's will, but are accidents dependent on cunning or mistakes or craft, or on the weakness of a diplomatist or a ruler or a party leader. So that the greater part of the events of history, civil wars, revolutions, and conquests are presented by these historians not as the result of free transferences of the people's will, but as results of the ill-directed will of one or more individuals, that is, once again, as usurpations of power. And so these historians also see and admit historical events which are exceptions to the theory. These historians resemble a botanist who, having noticed that some plants grow from seeds with two cotyledons, should insist that all that grows does so by sprouting into two leaves, and that the palm, the mushroom, and even the oak, which blossom in full growth and no longer resemble two leaves, are deviations from the theory. Historians of the third class assume that the will of the people is transferred to historic personages conditionally, but that the conditions are unknown to us. They say that historical personages have power only because they fulfill the will of the people which has been delegated to them. But in that case, if the force that moves nations lies not in the historic leaders, but in the nations themselves, what significance have those leaders? The leaders, are, these historians tell us, express the will of the people. The activity of the leaders represents the activity of the people. But in that case, the question arises whether all the activity of the leaders serves as an expression of the people's will, or only some part of it. If the whole activity of the leaders serves as the expression of the people's will, as some historians suppose, then all the details of the court scandals contained in the biographies of a Napoleon or a Catherine serve to express the life of the nation, which is evident nonsense. But if it is only some particular side of the activity of a historical leader which serves to express the people's life, as other so-called philosophical historians believe, then to determine which side of the activity of a leader expresses the nation's life, we first have all to know in what the nation's life consists. Met by the difficult historians of that class, devise some most obscure, impalpable, and general abstraction which can cover all conceivable occurrences, and declare this abstraction to be the aim of humanity's movement. The most usual generalizations adopted by almost all the historians are freedom, equality, enlightenment, progress, civilization, and culture. Postulating some generalization as the goal of the movement of humanity, the historians study the men of whom the greatest number of monuments have remained: kings, ministers, generals, authors, reformers, popes, journalists. To the extent to which, in their opinion, these persons have promoted or hindered that abstraction. But, as it is in no way proven that the aim of humanity does consist in freedom, equality, enlightenment, or civilization, and as the connection of the people with the rulers and enlighteners of humanity is only based on the arbitrary assumption that the collective will of the people is always transferred to the men whom we have noticed, it happens that the activity of the millions who migrate, burn houses, abandon agriculture, and destroy one another never is expressed in the account of the activity of some dozen people who did not burn houses, practice agriculture, or slay their fellow creatures. History proves this at every turn. Is the ferment of the peoples of the West at the end of the 18th century, and their drive eastwards explained by the activity of Louis XIV, XV, and XVI, their mistresses and ministers, and by the lives of Napoleon, Rousseau, Diderot, Beaumarchais, and others. Sorry about those names. Beaumarchais, Diderot. Is the movement of the Russian people eastwards to Kazan and Siberia expressed by details of the morbid character of John the Terrible and by his correspondence with Kerbsky? Is the movement of the peoples at the time of the Crusades explained by the life and activity of the Godfreys and the Louises and their ladies? For us, the movement of the peoples from west to east without leaders, with a crowd of vagrants and with Peter the Hermit, remains incomprehensible, and yet more incomprehensible is the cessation of that movement when a rational and sacred aim for the Crusade, the deliverance of Jerusalem, had been clearly defined by historic leaders, popes, kings, and knights incited the peoples to free the Holy Land, but the people did not go, for the unknown cause which had previously impelled them to go no longer existed. The history of the Godfreys and of the Minne Singers can evidently not cover the life of the peoples, and the history of the Godfreys and the Minne Singers has remained the history of Godfreys and Minne Singers, but the history of the life of the people and their impulses has remained unknown. Still less does the history of authors and reformers explain to us the life of the peoples. The history of culture explains to us the impulses and conditions of life and thought of a writer or a reformer, which we learn that Luther had a hot temper and said such and such things. We learn that Rousseau was suspicious and wrote such and such books, but we do not learn why, after the Reformation, the peoples massacred one another, nor why during the French Revolution they guillotined one another. If we unite both these kinds of history, as is done by the newest historians, we shall have the history of monarchs and writers, but not the history of the life of the peoples. All right, there we go, another chapter down, and I was actually reading just then. I wasn't taking the piss. I know that sounded like I was having some kind of stroke and just saying random words for 15 minutes, but those were apparently sentences that make actual sense in the world. Hey, it's 1 a.m. on the 25th of December, so we are 1 hour into Christmas time right here in Australia. So hey, Merry Christmas. It's Christmas. I'm doing a Christmas podcast. I'll probably do another one because I'll do one tomorrow night, but I probably won't do it quite so late. I'll probably do it before midnight, which will mean I'll do podcasting twice on Christmas. Damn. What a Christmassy miracle. Now, this chapter, I've got to say straight away, I might be a little bit biased here because I think this might be my favourite chapter of the book so far. I mean, just such powerful, powerful writing, and you just get the sense that the author's being unbiased and fair and balanced and using measured beats to eloquently and succinctly explain his point of view. It would have been very easy for Tolstoy to get carried away and, beat a dead horse for 15 minutes and just say the same thing over and over in a loop. But he didn't. He kept his points tight. He didn't kind of bash the point home too much. He was kind of a little bit self-restrained. Showed a great amount of discipline here by not just going off on some tangent. So I applaud you, Tolstoy. That was one of the most entertaining chapters of any book I think I've ever read. Original CJ5 said, "Is anyone else feeling extremely entertained by this chapter?" And had to read it 3 times. Original CJ5, I think I'm going to go straight back into this chapter when I finish the podcast and just probably just read it over and over until daylight, I think. Just keep reading it. Mellow Yellow said, "It is very entertaining. I loved it. We've come so far, and we're only a few days away from the end. So I'm pressing on and trying to digest as much of what Tolstoy is feeding me, but it's pretty dense and I'm having trouble chewing and swallowing. I have to admit that I'm spitting a lot of it out into my napkin. You're not the only one with analogies, Tolstoy. I'd say I'm more overwhelmed than bored. Yeah, in case you didn't notice, I'm taking the piss. Original CJ5 says, is anyone else feeling bored by this and having to skip the last few chapters? Mellow Yellow said, bored, sort of. We've come so far, blah, blah, blah. Mellow Yellow also said, I'm getting flashbacks of the reading comprehension sections from my SATs for non-Americans. Those are the standardized tests that high schoolers had to take before applying to college. Obi-Wan Spicoli said, I am bored, and I might just be done. I flipped forward and there doesn't appear to be any more story. I fear it is just going to be this for another 84 pages. Well, not 84 pages in my edition. We've only got about 20 or 30 to go. Mellow Yellow is right. We're so close to the end, but I am limping to the finish line. Tradana said, agreed, bad time to fall behind. It's not exactly binge reading material. I have to keep telling myself I've come this far. I'm only reading on because it feels ridiculous to not finish the whole thing at this point. If this chunk came earlier on, I might have thrown in the towel. I was thinking that while I was reading it, Tadana, I thought, if this was one of the early chapters in the first, you know, somewhere in the first 100 pages of this book, I would have gone, I'm out. I would have tapped out. I would have been like, yeah, look, if there's more of that in this book, nah, it's not for me. That was shocking. That was some of the worst writing I've ever read. I just think it's so inconsiderate for an author. My philosophy with writing is like, really with anything. It's like if someone lends you their attention, right, you need to give them back something of value. You need to appreciate that they're doing you a favor. So as soon as you open page one of my book, I owe you something, right? Because you've done me the favor of lending me your attention. So the least I can do is try to entertain you. Now, I suppose the value could be that he thinks he's bestowing knowledge onto us. But my problem there is that he's not simplifying what he's trying to say. He's adding complexity and making it really elaborate. And he's just making it more and more difficult to understand rather than, I'm sure whatever he's trying to say is not that complex. It's not that, it's not going to take 12 chapters of garbled nonsense to explain whatever he's trying to say. I'm sure he could probably summarize it down to a page or two. But I don't know. I used to read these technical documents back when I was a business analyst. And there was this thing that people would do where they would try to make the language more technical than it needed to be to sort of flex their intellect a little bit, to be like, look at all this complexity I can lay out here and all these big words I can use and all these fancy analogies and that kind of thing. Although they didn't use analogies in technical documents, but all it did was made it less likely that the reader would understand what they're saying. So it was counterproductive. It was a real pet peeve of mine. And the same with creative writing. It's like, simplify things. Don't go the other way. So to put this at the end of your book, it's like, to me, it's like an act of suicide, like sort of thing. It's like, you don't want people to leave the book liking it. You want them to dislike it. It's the only thing I can figure. He's not stupid. I mean, he knows we care about the characters more than his personal political opinions. And we don't want to hear him talk about historians. We know his opinion on historians. Also, the thing I was thinking is he lumps historians in as like, there's him, who is just a historian in a way. And then there's every other historian, and they all lumped into this like category of being wrong. It's like, you're either me or you're wrong. And it's just so, I don't know, it's hard to read, hard to get through. Ninjastro said, ugh. Good comment, Ninjastro. And I'm not being sarcastic. I 100% agree, and I'm upvoting you. DeFleury said, I cheated and came to read the comments before the chapter, and you guys are just confirming my worst fears. If we're doing analogies, it's like when you're doing fine in class all year and the final exam is full of problems from an entirely different, much more advanced course. It is like that. No, it's like you're reading a book, a fiction book, and you read it for 350 days in a row, and then on the 357th day, they go, oh, hey, by the way, this isn't a fiction book anymore. It's the most boring final exam from a uni course that you didn't want to do. And it's like, oh, well, the old switcheroo. I thought we were having fun here, but nope. It's time for you to rant and rave at me. God. Hey, it's Christmas. I'm getting upset at Tolstoy. It's Christmas. It's the most wonderful time and all that stuff. Rusev, he said, all I can read in these chapters at this point is that Tolstoy is super torn up about the meaninglessness of the horrible events of history. He keeps repeating this question of what drove men to kill each other and burn down houses, etc. It seems like this whole second epilogue is Tolstoy trying to find meaning in the senseless pain of life. This is an admirable question to tackle, but at this point I can't tell if he's found a solution or he's just taking us along his personal ride of reflection and disappointment. Biscuit Potter said, I feel like if any writer had discovered a solution to the meaning of life in the 19th century, we'd have heard about it before now. I'm wondering what theory he's building up to, though. Biscuit Potter, that's really funny. Rusifi, I like your optimism, and you've kept a level head, and you've actually talked about what the chapter was about, rather than just complaining about, it's too hard, like the rest of us. So, very well done. Biscuit Potter said, if he hadn't written the fictional stuff first, and just skipped to the epilogue, that's clearly what he really wanted to say, I bet Tolstoy would have been dismissed as a crackpot contrarian. Is it like it was all a cheap trick? It's like, I want people to read this 12-page diatribe that I need to get out of my system. It's extremely dry, extremely boring, and extremely condescending. How can I get people to read 12 pages of that? Oh, you know what? I'll stick it at the... 12 chapters. I'll stick it at the end of a 1,200-page novel, and then they'll feel like they have to get through it because, oh, well, they've come this far. It's just a big... The whole 12,000 pages prior was just a run-up to this to make us feel that, what's the sunken cost fallacy sort of thing. Biscuit Potter also said, actually, I guess I have no way of knowing if he would have been taken seriously by his contemporaries, but what I know for sure is that regular people like us with no special interest in Russian history would absolutely not be reading this a century or two later. It certainly wouldn't have been translated into English by like 30 different people over the years. I've said it before on this sub, but Tolstoy was playing the long game. The 1,000-plus pages game, to be precise. Oh my gosh. Hey, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do something different right now. I'm going to swerve away from this chapter because, let's be honest, we're all not feeling it. Someone posted, just recently, what were your top 5 favorite moments from the novel? And I had it in my head that I would save this till we finished the novel, but then looking through those top 5 moments, I mean, it's pretty safe to say none of them were from the second epilogue. So it's not going to spoil anything. It was Ernie Pook who posted it. Ernie's top 5 moments were the duel, the near abduction, Pierre's tour of the front lines, and they struggled to decide which events round out the 5, but Lisa's death, the horrible card game, and there were a lot of other events that could have made it. Oh, sorry, those were 3. The duel, the near abduction, and Pierre's tour of the front lines were his top 3. And then it was Lisa's death and the horrible card game. There was also Bolkonski's math lesson meltdown, Petya's shocking death, Denisov's Mazurka, The Fight for the Will. It's such a huge book that I'm sure I've missed something big. Please remind me. Sue Dynamic said, my favourite moments, Pierre shooting Dolokhov in the duel, Pierre tying a bear to a policeman, Natasha and Nicholas going hunting, Pierre joining the Freemasons, Maria dealing with her dying father and her guilt. And Sue said, I didn't realise just how much I enjoyed Pierre in all of this. Chattel Velster said, Pierre being told about the Freemasons on the train. The chapter which ends with Andre having his first epiphany after seeing the clear blue sky. The chapter where Tolstoy used a beehive as an analogy for emptied out Moscow. Andre finishing all the jobs on his land that Pierre started. The opera where Natasha met Helena and Anatole. Libby Stitch's top five were The Hunting Party, Petya's War, I Gasped When That Bullet Went Through His Head, Andre's Death, and how it finally brought closure to the whole ruined Natasha arc and brought Natasha and Maya together, and his lament at seeing Anatole's injuries brought me to tears, the attempt at getting Anatole and Maya married, and Pierre's arc once Moscow had fallen. To say he's the main character, I don't think Pierre had much of an impact on me. I much preferred spending time with the others. I really loved Pierre. I think, oh God, it's really hard to say, but you know, that opening scene of Anna Pavlovna's soiree is kind of burned into my mind. I don't know why. It's such a strong opening though. And, I don't know. It might just be because that's where the novel starts, but it's just so vivid in my head. I also liked, you know, after the soiree, Pierre goes on and gets drunk, and the whole, the dare, the sitting on the ledge and drinking the alcohol dare, that was actually before they went off and tied the bear to the policeman. But I really liked that scene where Pierre is sort of trying to show off to Dolokhov. I quite liked that scene. It was towards the end where there was that really badass guy who went off and did some crazy stuff. Man, I think he was under Denisov's control, and it was when they were raiding all the French camps and stuff. Well, I think it was the French were in retreat from Moscow by this point. And Tikhon was his name. He was pretty badass. I kind of thought that was cool. What else? There's too many. There was a really nice chapter where I think Natasha was sung and it cheered someone up. Pierre, maybe? Or Nicholas? Yeah. I think I've only said four, but I'm going to leave it there because A lot of mine would be the moments that everyone's listed here so far. They're all way up there for me as well. Especially the opera as a big one. The hunting party, that was a great scene, but it was a very long chapter. And I remember just being like struggling to get through it because it was a long chapter. But it was a good chapter. Yeah, what else was good? The oak tree. Andre having his reflections on the oak tree was quite cool. And I was also thinking about how it was a few chapters ago when it was that bit about, I can't remember exactly what it said, but it was like how the servants don't participate in the conversations with their masters. They just observe their masters' actions. So they don't hear what their masters say and what their opinions are or what they claim to be their values, but they see their masters' values through their actions. Which is to say, like, actions speak louder than words, because someone can keep insisting that they're a good person. They can do a bad thing and say, oh, I'm so sorry, that it was a complete accident. That's not like me at all. I know what came over me. And that's taking into account what they say, but they still did the action. right? And then if they continue to do those actions, like the sum of what a person is what they did, not what they said, you know? The sum of what a person was, you know, after the fact, is the things that they did, not the things that they said. Well, it's more so the things they did than the things they said, I should say. Yeah, it's what you do, not what you say. It's kind of like that simple fact, I think, is embedded in so much other wisdom. Like, you think about, like, that golden rule thing. Do unto others as you would wish they would unto do forth, henceforth, Aberforth, Dumbledore, unto you. Or however it goes, I can't remember exactly, you know, you get the gist of it, but it's about what you do. Do unto others, right? And that throws me way back to early in the book. I think it was in the first war, which I can't actually remember the setting of that, but the early war, 1806 or 7 or whatever it was. Austria? Was it Austria? God, I hope I got that right. Otherwise, I'm going to be so embarrassed. And we had that general who had to ride to the front lines. He might not have been a general, some kind of commander or general or something. He was to ride to the front lines, the most dangerous part of the battlefield, and tell the Russian troops that they needed to retreat, that they were losing, and that it was time to run. And so he, on his horse, he rode off towards the front lines, and he headed there, and he got just near the battlefield, and then he swerved, and he just rode away. He just did a runner. Gone. And it's like, that's what he did, see? Like, if you would have asked him, are you a brave person or a cowardly person? He would have said, I'm a brave person. You know, I'm at this war. I'm fighting for my country. That's what he would have said. But his actions told a different story. And there was lots of examples of that. And that was one thing I loved about Tolstoy's characters, is that they said one thing, but they did very different things. Or they would claim to be a certain way, but they did not always portray those qualities that they claimed to have. Which is good. It's a mark of a good writer. Because that's how people are in the real world. Alright. This was a long, 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 long episode. So, let's wrap it up. Thank you for listening. I'll see you tomorrow. Have a great Christmas.